Welcome to the Let's Talk EMDR podcast, brought to you by the EMDR International Association, or EMDRIA. I am your host, Kim Howard. In this episode, we are discussing EMDR therapy and military personnel and veterans. Today's guest is EMDR therapist, Dr. Jamie Zubukovic. Jamie is based in Dallas, Texas, and has extensive experience working with clients who are either active duty personnel or veterans. Let's get started. Today we are speaking with an EMDR therapist and approved consultant, Dr. Jamie Zubukovic, about working with military personnel and veterans. Jamie has worked in primary ambulatory care and medical specialty clinics, including chronic pain clinic, mental health, homeless, and PTSD units during her VA career. An EMDR Institute facilitator since 1991, Jamie provided EMDR training within the VA, Vet Center, and Department of Defense. She is an author, speaker, trainer, facilitator, and consultant. Thank you, Jamie, for being here today. We are so happy that you said yes.
Well, Kim, thank you for the invitation. And for all of you service members, veterans, and EMDR therapists who work with these individuals, thank you for your service. And of course, we can't leave out the family. You know, thank you for your service too.
Yeah, I was a military brat, so I know all about that commitment, not just for the service member, but from the family who is connected to that service member. It's a big deal. So.
Oh, absolutely. It really affects all the systems of which that person is a part. And I also just want to mention that we're going to be referring to all branches of the service. So that includes the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, National Guard, Coast Guard, and also the Space Force.
Okay, that's good. Thank you for the disclaimer. Let's get started. So tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming an EMDR therapist.
Before I began to work with veterans and service members, I was a family, child, and adolescent therapist at Warren Township Youth Services in Gurnee, Illinois. I'd been trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, client-centered therapy, gestalt, hypnosis, and a number of different family approaches. You know, I did outdoor adventure trips with teens and their families. And we also did a transition to high school group with at-risk youth. So many of our clients experience trauma, and I began to understand their behavior in the context of trauma. And also got the idea that, you know, you needed to use whatever worked with them. So maybe that kind of also let me be a little bit more open to EMDR. I worked on the stress disorder treatment unit at the North Chicago VA, which is now FCC level. So I got exposed to the different perspectives of a number of very talented clinicians. So Jim Moore, who focused on family relationships, Skip Shelton, Orville Lips. Yes, that is his real name. James Besner, Howard Lipke, Al Botkin, Janine Goldstein, and Bob McFarland. So all of these approaches included cognitive behavioral therapy, rational emotive therapy, strict behavior therapy, couples and family therapy, and of course, stress management. In addition to trauma processing groups, I did a group on human sexuality, a guilt group, a relaxation group, and a rational emotive therapy type group where veterans would present an issue and the entire group would work through it, challenging automatic thoughts and determining other maybe more appropriate courses of action instead of just going off on people.
You mean that doesn't work well?
No, but you know, when you're stuck with a particular way of thinking or believing that you can end up kind of filling in the blank for different events that can occur and you can react in a certain way. And then later on you go, why did I do that? So we really tried to help them to find other ways of thinking and other ways of behaving in situations that were problematic. Back in December of 1989, there was an article that came out about the flagship VA, the American Lake VA's 90-day treatment program for PTSD. And they presented the results of a survey that indicated that about 26.6% of the veterans who attended that program, a 90-day program, felt that they benefited from it. And they used a variety of approaches. They did flooding, relaxation training, dream analysis. I mean, just a lot of state-of-the-art at that time treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, around the same time, Francine Shapiro published an article saying that 80% of the clients she worked with felt better after just one session of what was then called EMD. pretty striking differences in the results. So, of course, our staff being the people that we were, we read the article, we tried it on each other, and we discovered that it worked. You know, so then we asked for volunteers from the stress unit and saw some amazing results. And I was actually trained by Shapiro in EMDR in 1990. But I was pretty skeptical about it at first. And one of the first clients that I worked with talked about a recurring nightmare he had when his chopper was shot down and he felt helpless. So he would have this nightmare where he would see the smoke and he would realize the engine cowling was on fire and he would wake up in a sweat. So we decided to target that nightmare. And he started with a high SUD level, I think about an 8 on that 0 to 10 scale. And after each set, he reported that his SUD level decreased. He actually began to remember additional parts of the event and remembered that after the chopper hit the ground, he had a weapon. He wasn't as helpless as he thought. So his SUD level went from an 8 to a 5 to a 3 to a 0.5 to a 0.1 to a 0.001.
That's great.
When I asked him what kept it from being a 0, he said, I got to be a little resistant. Later on, I asked him if he had ever remembered those additional parts of the event that came up in the session. And he said no, which again, I thought was, well, this is really interesting. And this happened in one session. So comparing that with maybe the more traditional approaches, I thought, gosh, I wonder how long it would have taken me to help him to get to that part to resolve that nightmare. And he continued to report while he was on the 90-day program that he did not have that nightmare again.
We hear stories like that all the time about people who have come to EMDR therapy and found a solution that helps them. So it's good to know that it's
absolutely right, Kim.
Yeah. What's your favorite part of working with EMDR therapy?
I was going to say, you know, just seeing the change in the client coming from the client's own brain and experience. But what popped into my mind is it's kind of like riding a bucking bronco sometimes. You know, you never know what's going to come up. What you think might come up or how the client might respond is different. But what is really cool about it is that, you know, it fits with the client. It comes from that client's own brain, their own experience. And another aspect is that just, you know, I remember that psychoanalysts would always talk about how the symptoms made sense. And certainly that really fits with the EMDR approach and the adaptive information processing model. You know, you start to think, where did this symptom come from? Did it come from trauma? What kind of trauma? Trauma from the military? Trauma from childhood? More recent trauma? Whether it's a big T or a small T, you know, you start to look at the symptoms in context and where they came from. When I've been working with clients, I often find myself thinking, gosh, you know, if I was the best therapist ever, not saying that I'm not, but, you know, if I was the best therapist ever, maybe I could get the client to accept one of those alternative beliefs, one of those positive self-statements that they come up with in order to resolve a traumatic memory. But it's so interesting because the client comes up with those beliefs. And it doesn't take them years to do that. The other thing I want to say that I think is one of the things that I really love about EMDR therapy is that doing cognitive behavioral therapy or cognitive processing therapy, so many veterans would come in and say, well, doc, it makes sense to me here, and they would point to their head, but it doesn't make sense here, and they would point to their heart. So that ending belief, that positive cognition that we install is the client's, and it feels congruent for them. It's not just something that makes sense in their head, but in their heart and throughout their body.
That's a good perspective. So that's a good segue to the next question, which is, what successes have you seen using EMDR therapy for veterans and military personnel?
Back in 1992, Kim, when I was at the North Chicago VA, Howard Lipke, Al Botkin, and I presented a small research study in which we asked the veterans to predict how successful they thought EMDR was going to be, and then also had them attribute what percentage of the trauma was related to, one, something that happened to me, two, something I did, three, something I saw someone else do, or four, something I should have done and didn't do. You know, so I guess back then we're talking about kind of moral injury as a part of the trauma. But the important thing that came out of that small study was that it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether or not somebody thought EMDR would be effective and what the percentage of trauma was due to those various attributions. They got better. So, of course, you know, I have a lot of other stories, a lot of anecdotal instances that indicate successful outcomes. You know, I had one client who wrote me up for an award that said that if he had met me 10 years earlier, I probably would have saved his marriage. Now, wow. I don't know if that would actually be true.
That's a big burden to carry on your shoulders.
Right. But it sure meant a lot to me what he said. And it showed just how meaningful the treatment had been to him.
That's great. That's very good. Are there any myths that you would like to bust about EMDR therapy in this population?
Yes. Actually, I had a couple other stories I wanted to share too.
Go ahead. Absolutely.
Of successes. You know, when I worked on a homeless domiciliary, most of the veterans had some kind of guilt about something. It was something, some way in which they were stuck so that they couldn't move in a positive direction in their life. So, for instance, one of the veterans that I worked with felt he just did not deserve. I mean, he couldn't get a job because he felt like he didn't deserve to be interviewed. I mean, he didn't even feel like he could, that he deserved to enter a store, enter a building, et cetera. So, I mean, you think about how that might impact someone who's trying to get out in the work world and also to find a home. Certainly that would prevent it. So in exploring this with him, I found out that the did not deserve went back to when he was a child and he and his family were migrant workers. Hmm. He always felt less than. Mm-hmm. And you know, when he would be in an interview and he would be questioned about stuff, he would act out in anger, which only added to his difficulties getting a job. But once we began to target the incidents related to the migrant worker family moving from situation to situation and never feeling like they belonged, he began to change. He continued treatment while in the homeless dom and was able to get additional training and a job. So
that's wonderful.
So many things, you know, not only did I deal with PTSD, but also medical issues, including chronic pain. And during the 10 years I worked in the chronic pain clinic, I had many veterans whose lives improved from EMDR. One fellow ended up coaching his son's soccer team. Another was able to visit his in-laws and able to manage his pain during that situation, which was an accomplishment for him. But a story that I like to tell is that one of my first patients that I did EMDR with was a chronic pain patient, and he didn't want to deal with his PTSD issues. He wanted to deal with his pain. So we focused on his pain. You know, now I know a lot more and I realize, boy, that pain could connect directly to one of those traumatic incidents. But back then, again, it was one of my first EMDR patients. So he decided he wanted to work on the pain. And I asked him, you know, what image, symbol, or picture represented that pain to him. And he said, burnt orange corduroy. And he reported it was a set of 8. And then we did a couple sets and he reported that it was, his set level was 3. And he had the image of cool green silk. So a big change. When I asked him what it would take to make a 3 a 0, he responded, I need some pain so I won't overdo it or hurt myself. Obviously, that was about a blocking belief that needed to be targeted. But to have that happen in one session after working with chronic pain as long as I had, that was pretty incredible. I had another veteran with phantom limb pain who had difficulty adjusting to his prosthesis. So he had a prosthetic leg and they had to continue to modify the prosthesis and also, for lack of a more euphemistic term, they had to modify his stump that the prosthesis was attached to. And he was very angry with the prosthesis. He was angry at having to use it. It didn't feel a part of him. And so he just was really having difficulty adjusting. So we worked on the phantom limb pain and he began to view his prosthesis differently. He also brought in several family members to meet me and so that they could see what he was doing. I guess they needed to check out and make sure that I wasn't doing anything additionally to hurt him. But later on, he was crossing some railroad tracks and his prosthesis got stuck.
Oh,
Yes. And so several veterans actually lifted him out and helped him to get out safely. And when I asked him about that, he didn't seem to be distressed about it. He just said the prosthesis was doing what it was designed to do, which was to be like a leg for him. And he was more focused on the veterans who had helped him get out. Probably one of the most touching stories that I have, though, is that I was referred a veteran who had stage 4 throat cancer. And he was referred to me. This fellow had problems even sitting still long enough for them to determine where they needed to aim the radiation treatment. So they would get him down on the table and they would put a mask over him and connect the mask to the table. And then they would try to get him to sit still so that they could, again, figure out where's the source of the cancer and where do we need to aim that radiation treatment. And he had tried everything from cognitive behavioral therapy to really heavy doses of anti-anxiety medications. He was so anxious, it didn't matter. He would still have a hard time sitting on the table. And then after he left the clinic, he would go home and sleep for days because that's when the anti-anxiety medications would take effect. So they tried cutting the mask open so that he would find it easier to breathe, but that didn't work either. So finally, one of the psychiatrists on the medical side of the house decided to refer him to me, thinking maybe I could do hypnosis or maybe even EMDR on a near drowning incident he had from childhood that they thought made it difficult for him to tolerate the mask. But I'm going to tell you that near drowning incident was only one of so many traumatic incidents that this person experienced. You know, in talking with me, I discovered that in addition to a horrible childhood, the cancer itself, the diagnosis, the responses of medical providers, et cetera, were also very traumatic to him. You know, one of the things he said, how do you go from nothing to stage 4 cancer in a year? And when he couldn't sit still, the radiation technician also chastised him, saying the oncologist wasn't going to be happy with him. So again, that's another kind of trauma related to the treatment and the cancer. Another medical staff member told him that the anxiety he had was overcoming the huge doses of medications he was given. So he gets referred to me, and I know time is really of the essence for this fellow. They needed to get his treatment going. So, you know, I'm finding myself thinking, as I'm conceptualizing the case, well, what do I do with this person? They have so much trauma. And I decided, because of the limited time that we had together, that I would do a combination of resource development and installation in a future template. So I asked him what skills or abilities, what behavior he might need to have in order to be able to undergo the test and treatment. And he said he would need to be able to sit still. So I asked him if he ever experienced having that ability. You know, we look for those mastery experiences. And he responded that, I know you're going to think this is crazy, but I used to love to dance. And one dance I used to do was the pop lock. So you just kind of freeze, you know. So he demonstrated that in session and we installed that and used a future rehearsal. He also said that it would help if I was there with him and if they played music when he was undergoing the test. So that's what we did. I went with him to the oncology clinic. We played music for him and he was able to stay still long enough to determine where the radiation treatment would be most beneficial. And eventually he used that skill to undergo treatment.
Those are good success stories. We like to hear that. So do you want to talk about any myths that you'd like to bust about EMDR therapy in this population?
Absolutely. You know, one of the big myths is that military trauma is only about blood and guts, you know, and I think that scares some people off. They're like, how can I work with the military if that's the case? But really, there's so much more. You know, there are so many other types of traumas that people can experience in their service. And that can include betrayal trauma, moral injury, sexual trauma. You know, individuals can have issues with sleep, addictions, harassment, medical issues, everything from issues with dealing with command and authority, motor vehicle accidents, parachute accidents, to dealing with relationships before, during, and after deployment. I think it's Camille Zeider who's done a presentation at one of the Andrea conferences on, you know, dealing with transitions in the military, including after deployment, and just how to work with that. Individuals can be concerned about what they were exposed to during their period of service. So toxins, smoke, water, gas, and the impact on their children and family. So you really have to listen to the client to learn how they've changed and when that happened. And another thing I'd like to mention, Kim, is that, you know, I was talking with a colleague just the other day, and one of the subjects came up was that we all assume that service members know about PTSD and accurately know what PTSD is, but that really isn't true. You know, there are a lot of service members and veterans and family members who don't know or understand what PTSD is. And it may seem surprising that you often have to teach the service member and their family about what it is. I can think of a Marine who, you know, had full-blown symptoms of PTSD, but he wasn't having it that he had PTSD, because his view of it was that PTSD was something that people came up with to get out of some of their job duties. You know, if they didn't want to go out on patrol while they were having PTSD, maybe they get sent home. So, you know, you have to look at, you know, what is their understanding about what PTSD is and figure out, how am I going to work with this person? Another big myth is that no one in the VA system does EMDR. And I hear this all the time. I mean, and here it is, like 32 years since EMDR has been introduced to the VA. It really isn't true that no one in the VA system does EMDR. We have over 600 clinicians who are part of a monthly VA Vet Center and Department of Defense conference call. And there are, that's not the only conference call within the system. There are other monthly calls for employees of the VA and Vet Center. The VA also has what they call their EMDR SharePoint, which if you are an EMDR trained clinician, you can access it, and it contains articles, templates for progress notes, et cetera, that can be accessed by VA and Vet Center staff. So those are the myths that I would really like to bust.
Those are good points. I was at a presentation and I can't remember who the speaker was or what the subject was, but it was somehow related to military service and PTSD. And the speaker said something about, you know, I learned very quickly that not all VA locations offer EMDR, which is likely true, right? It really depends on who is on staff there and whether they offer it. But
right.
The way that she made the statement made it sound like it wasn't common knowledge in the VA. And then people in the chat were like, that's not true. You know, this is something that it can be found in the VA. If people are offering this services, that statement is not exactly accurate. And so it's good for you to reinforce that, for people to know that. And I also think, going back to your comment about the Marine who had PTSD and had all the symptoms and didn't recognize it or didn't want to recognize it, I think sometimes there's, even within the different branches of military, there is a level of expectation about how they are and who they are and where they serve. You know, like, this branch is the toughest and this branch is this and this. And so they take that mentality and they look at things like being sick or PTSD or anything like that that impacts them and their health. And they're like, well, that can't happen to me because I'm a Marine. You know, I'm the toughest of the branch. I'm the first in or whatever. And so I think there's a little bit of that mentality happening with service members that that happens to the weaker branches, not me, you know. And so I can see how he would think that.
Yeah, I'm a Marine.
I'm a Marine. I'm the toughest.
Marine,
yes, that's not who we are.
I'm Special Forces. I was a Navy SEAL, blah, blah. You know, it's not going to happen to me. It only happens to people who have a weakness.
Right.
But early on, Ray Winker from the Murfreesboro, Tennessee VA had said, every human being has a price. And he said, you know, it doesn't have to do with weakness. There are just certain things that can affect us.
Yeah.
And so we really have to find ways to present information to the vets and service members so that they can accept what it is that they're experiencing and allow you to work with it.
And you truly don't know. I mean, my dad was in the Army. He was a lifer and he did two tours in Vietnam and he passed away in 2019. And you really, truly don't understand how you're going to respond in a wartime situation or a conflict situation until you're put into it. And so you really don't know how it's going to impact you until you're in it or after it. And then that's when people realize, you know, that that saying that war is hell is not an understatement. And mm-hmm. and what it does to someone's psyche to be involved in that kind of situation, even if they didn't necessarily encounter something that was horrendous or horrible that they did or somebody that they know did, they're in that really stressful situation. And, you know, trauma that they've had in the past, childhood, teenager, young person trauma can all kind of bubble up to the surface. And you have no idea how that's going to impact you. And then all of a sudden you're in that situation, or you've come back from the deployment and you're like, well, my life is not the same and I'm not the same and what happened. And so it's good that, thank God, there are resources out there for military and personnel and veterans. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thanks, Kim.
Are there any specific complexities or difficulties with using EMDR therapy with veterans and military personnel?
Well, certainly active duty personnel, you have to consider, you know, the possibility that you might have to report back to someone in higher authority, you know, depending on what your position is. If you're in the Department of Defense, you may have that mandate where you have to report back to someone from command. But you certainly would want to make sure that you have consent forms signed by your client. Another important consideration is just how much time do you have to work with this veteran or service member? Why is the person in treatment? And why did they come into treatment now? One of the difficulties that people often report is that it can be difficult for the client to buy into looking at earlier childhood or developmental events that can be contributing to their current issues. You know, so you have to figure out how you're going to do that dance of that therapeutic alliance to try to get them to understand that this is part of a bigger picture. But again, if you don't have that much time to work with an individual, then you're going to have to consider other approaches. Or even if the person is so adamant about not wanting to deal with childhood stuff, or if there's a sense of urgency about needing to deal with current triggers, then you can still use EMDR or some aspects of it by dealing with current triggers, a future template, or even using EMD, you know, so more restricted processing, just focusing on a particular event. And Kim, sometimes veterans report experiencing numbness about a particular experience. And so therapists often are, you know, confused about, well, what do I do with that? You know, I ask them what emotions they're experiencing and they say they feel numb. Well, you can go with that. It's like, where do you feel that numbness? Where do you notice that in your body? How distressing does that numbness feel to you? When did you first experience that? You know, and sometimes tracing that numbness goes back to earlier childhood stuff. You also have to consider secondary gain because it can be a factor in working with this population. You know, how will improving that veteran or service member situation impact disability, compensation, you know, whether or not they go out on deployment, legal issues, or even their role in the family? And as for the therapist, I guess this also relates to complexity. I can't stress enough. And some of this, I know that I wrote about Go With That magazine, the military issue. So, but I just really want to stress that because I think it's so important that, first of all, the therapist really needs to be aware of themselves and their own belief systems. So asking yourself, why am I working with this population? Now, what is your family history? Just as you have family history with some military background, were there or are there veterans or service members in your family? And as a therapist, you really have to be aware of what you bring into the session. You know, in the olden days, we used to talk about transference and countertransference, but it still can be a meaningful discussion. So it's important to be aware of your own stuff and how it can affect treatment. For instance, a clinician might view themselves as being very positive and very supportive of veterans and service members, but you have to look at the flip side of that. How is that view going to impact the therapeutic alliance and what the client's going to share with you? Or, you know, how you might view what they say? What might you miss or downplay if that's who you are? Your client may have difficulty telling you about some horrible things they may have done. because that could impact how they view you. And again, you just have to be genuine. Sarah Haley, back in 1974, talked about that the establishment of that therapeutic alliance is the therapy, is the treatment. So I can't emphasize that enough. You have to have a good therapeutic alliance with that client. Also, remaining neutral without judgment. You have to be connected and compassionate with your clients. Again, that client may have some horrific things to share or something that they're very ashamed about. So you really have to listen. You want to respect the service member or the veteran. And one of the important things is don't try to pretend you know or understand when you don't. You know, you might have to take time to learn about that service, about that particular war deployment, that unit or squad. You really need to take time to understand that service member or veteran's unique experience. And they are all unique. Just as, you know, EC Hurley, Jan Click, and I did a presentation for MDRIA 1 year, and we were talking about how when you work for one VA, you work for one VA. They're all different. And the same is true for the veterans and service members, even if they're a part of the same branch, or even if they're part of a special unit or group, they're very different. So you need to tune into what those differences are. The last thing I want to say for therapists is you really have to make sure you take care of yourself. Again, I think that article in Go With That magazine, I mentioned self-compassion and self-care, but really you're going to be hearing some very intimate, very horrific things, and you need to take care of yourself.
Those are great tips for therapists. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. I'm going to ask you, how do you practice cultural humility as an EMDR therapist?
Yes. First of all, you have to be aware of military culture. And then, you know, it's like an onion. There are other aspects of other cultures related to the groups of which the service member or veteran is a part. So again, when we think about culture, what are we talking about? We're talking about values and ideals. You know, so Marines, you know, Semper Fi, forever faithful, you know, so that's a big ideal, but sometimes that doesn't hold true with people's military experience. Beliefs, the worldview, what is the world like, you know, the real world or back in, you know, back home where everyone's safe. How is it different from, you know, what you have to deal with when you're in war or combat situation? How does it affect their worldview? You know, what interests are common to that culture and what behavior and customs? And of course, special language. So when you meet with somebody from the military or a veteran, you know, they can talk in slang terms. And
so many acronyms. Like, what does that mean again?
Yeah. So and sometimes I get caught up in that too. I think I've referred to some abbreviations in some of the presentations that I've done, and people are like, well, what does that mean? You know, and I kind of had assumed that they understood, but they didn't. That special language. So learning a little bit about that. When I started on the stress unit in North Chicago, so this is back in 1987, when I was an intern, they actually gave us like a list of common Vietnam terms and what they meant. So that was very helpful. But, you know, as time has gone on, you continue to see how that special language develops. The other thing about culture, it helps us define what is normal, what's accepted, you know, what emotions we're okay to express, you know, what our emotions are okay to express now. Culture helps us to find our place. It helps us define who we are and how we relate to others. And as Shapiro had said, and even Brene Brown, nobody likes to be cut off from the herd. And so people may do things to try to adapt to the culture that may not fit for them. And so that could be a potential target for treatment. But the most important thing is you have to ask about culture when you're interviewing the client, you know, race, ethnicity, gender, spiritual beliefs, preferences. And so one of the questions that I like to ask is, what cultural or diversity values and beliefs do they have that are important to treatment? You know, so somebody might say, Well, it's important for my family to be involved on some level. Okay, I'm gonna bring in the family. I'm gonna do some stuff with them. Or what strengths and skills do they have that will assist with treatment? And veterans, when you ask them that, very often they look at you like, what are you talking about? What strengths and skills? If I had strengths and skills, I wouldn't be here. No, but so I'll say something like, well, you know, like you'll come in for sessions even if you don't want to. Oh yeah, I'll do that. Okay. So that's a strength. What else do you have? I know how to relax. So you start to learn about that individual and, you know, what's important to treatment, what's going to help. In terms of the service, you want to ask about that particular branch of service, what their job was, what the atmosphere of their unit or squad was, how they got along with others, et cetera. You know, what's their identity? How do they identify themselves in that group? For branch of service, how did they choose it? What does it mean to them? And what were their expectations when they joined? What was their mission? Again, what was their unit or squad like? And what was the atmosphere? What was their rank? Did they lose rank? What was their work or job experience? You know, what kind of educational experiences did they have while they were in the service? And their family and other social groups, how did their deployments, their service impact their family, friends, and loved ones? For instance, I have a good example, Kim, if we have time.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. I worked with somebody who decided she wanted to be a nurse in a particular branch of service because she liked the uniform. The colors suited her better.
You know what? A lot of people have joined certain branches of the military, mostly the Marines, because they like the dress blue. I mean, they like the uniform. It's not uncommon.
No. Yeah. And, you know, when we're younger, we don't always make the best decisions based on all of the information that's available. So, but for this person, that's what she decided. She liked the uniform. She looked good in it. Although her medical record indicated she was Caucasian, when I asked her about cultural diversity issues and her ethnic background, she reported that she was Creek Indian. Oh. So again, yeah. It's important to ask. Now, this individual always felt out of place, and she always felt that she had to hide who she was because she was a lesbian. And that was way before don't ask, don't tell. If you were lesbian, you could lose rank. You could even be booted out of the military. And so here's this individual who ends up being raped while she's in the military. And she felt that she was treated like it was her fault, that she brought it on herself. But she wanted to tell people, no, you know, I did not want this. I'm a lesbian. But she couldn't bring that up. And she would have had to reveal who she was. So she beat up on herself for so many years for not speaking out. But when we targeted that with EMDR, she came to understand that she did the best that she could at the time. And she was able to understand the context in which this was set, not to judge herself from the comfort of my office or her home, because that really wasn't realistic. It's really unfair for folks to judge themselves from where they're sitting at now, once you remove them from that context in which the trauma occurred. So when I was at the Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Washington PERP, the PTSD Residential Rehabilitation Program, I think whoever came up with that acronym was really made a mistake. PERP, P-R-R-P. So when I was there, we worked closely with the Northwest Indian Veterans Association. And so we incorporated various Native American ceremonies with the rest of the therapeutic work that we did. So we had smudges. So for those of you who don't know what that is, it's kind of a cleansing ceremony, similar to incense and religious ceremonies, or think of Buddhists cleansing themselves with smoke. And we use various materials such as sage, kinnikinick, and juniper, particularly juniper for nightmares. And we brought in Native American elders to be a part of treatment. But we also made sure when we were doing the smudges that we contacted engineering so that they would turn off the sprinkler system so it wouldn't go off in the middle of. And what's interesting is that one of the engineers that worked with us on this, he said, well, I'll do it on one condition. You'll let me participate in the ceremony.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I interviewed Shelley Spear Chief a couple of months ago for a podcast, and she talked about using very similar bilateral stimulation was with the natural arts healings of Native Americans and how those things coalesce and the drum beats and the music and all of those things are connected. And I also interviewed, been about a year ago, an MDRIA member who worked with a lot of service personnel and veterans and military. And she said, you know, a lot of times people who have been in the military can't necessarily get to a sud of a zero because they have been trained and ingrained to be at the ready always. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost impossible for them to get to a zero or a one because it's just not the nature of what they've been trained to do. And mm-hmm. so I thought that was an interesting perspective because you were talking about your clients earlier and what levels they were going through and how they could not quite get to zero. They had to hold back just a tiny little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that military training coming to them naturally saying you have to be ready, whatever the ready is. So if you're a nurse or if you're somebody who's the guy who's fixing the plane or the helicopter, or if you're infantry, and so you have to be at the ready. And so that's another cultural thing that as a therapist, you would want to be aware of is that that's how they're trained. And so that becomes part of who they are.
Yes. And that is, again, Kim, that is so important to be aware of. So for those clients who have difficulty with that, I really want to make sure that they understand what the SUD level is. SUD level is not the intensity of an emotion. It's not, you know, how ready you are. It's how distressing or disturbing that incident, that experience is to you right now. On that scale from zero, being calm or neutral, not absence of emotion, not absence of even adrenaline, but neutral or no disturbance. To a 10, which is the worst amount of disturbance you could ever experience or ever imagine experiencing. So making sure that they understand that. And for some veterans, you know, it's like that they feel like they have to be ready, they have to be prepared. So they don't want to let go of that hyper alert, hyper aroused state. And it's like, okay, it's kind of like that smoke alarm that's going off all the time. It's really, really sensitive to stuff. So do you want to do something so that it'll still go off when it needs to, but it's not going off all the time. As you mentioned too, Kim, you know, some of the dancing, some of the marching, you know, the veteran powwows also reminded me of bilateral stimulation or dual attentional stimulation, whatever you'd call it. I have another experience that I'd like to share too. I worked with a Korean War veteran who was a Marine, one of the first Black Marines that was part of an integrated service. So some of his traumas included things like having to dig his own foxhole because no one wanted him to join them in theirs. And so again, when you think about this, we were talking earlier about they're the Marines whose motto is Semper Fi, which means right. always faithful. And yet here
his
he didn't
colleagues
feel
were correct. Not faithful. Right. Yeah. They weren't right. faithful to him simply because of his skin color. Yeah.
And if they wouldn't share a foxhole with him, what would that mean when they were in battle?
Yeah.
So, you know, he didn't feel like they had his back. So we reprocessed that and some of the other traumas he experienced. And he ended up just being really proud of his service and who he was. So what I'd like for people to know is that while you don't have to know everything about a particular branch of service, the veteran or service member shouldn't have to explain everything to you as a therapist. So as far as learning about military culture, there are a lot of resources out there. So Dr. Carrie Kennedy has done some wonderful presentations. She also wrote a book on military psychology. But again, she's not the only one. And in our own EMDR community, we have folks like Steve Silver, Susan Rogers, E.C. Hurley, who passed away in the past couple of years, Mark Russell and Charles Figley. And again, Howard Lipke, Richard Smith, Camille Zeider, Jim Knipe, and Nancy Erebo are some of the other individuals who have talked about EMDR culture with this population.
Great suggestions. Most of those names I do recognize. So do you have a favorite free EMDR related resource you'd like to suggest for the public or other EMDR therapists?
So Kim, one of the things that I like to tell people whenever they're going to use a resource, whether it's free or whether they're paying for it, is that before they use it with a client, they need to review it themselves. But there are some great free ones out there. The National Center for PTSD is a pretty good resource. They have pamphlets that you can print comparing EMDR with other evidence-based psychotherapies. They also have an EMDR whiteboard and a PTSD whiteboard. What is PTSD? So those can be good things to share with clients. But again, you need to review them yourselves first. And the other one is howardlipke.com. I mean, Howard has always been very giving with his materials. And so he has a lot of free items on his website. So he also has pamphlets that can be used to explain PTSD to family members, how to talk with your family member about post-traumatic stress disorder. He also developed the Great Lakes Event Questionnaire, which lists out a number of traumatic events that the client can endorse that they've experienced. And you can use that as a part of your clinical interview. You know, it isn't something that you would have them do on their own because of some of the experiences that are listed there. A good resource all the same.
That's a great suggestion. Thank you. What would you like people outside of the EMDR community to know about veterans and military personnel?
Well, Kim, you're probably aware of this because of your family background, your dad. When we talk about people going into the service, we're talking about people who are giving things up to serve our country. And, you know, one way to begin to explore their experiences is to ask what they gave up when they went into the service, how their life changed. Did they experience anything that they would consider to be traumatic when they were in the service? So kind of general questions, but you really want to find out, you know, how entering the service really affected that person. And the other thing that I would like to mention is that Haim Chetan, who was an early vet center therapist, referred to PTSD as impacted grief. So we get stuck with guilt and shame. And when what we've experienced is a loss of a part of our body or functioning, a loss of a belief in the world as a fair and just place, a loss of a buddy or a loved one, or a loss of a sense of self. So even with what some folks refer to as moral injury, there's loss. So as a therapist, you need to help the client process that loss and grieve.
That's good information. Thank you. If you were not an EMDR therapist, what would you be?
What a great question, Kim.
I've heard some really interesting answers since I started asking this question. I always like to hear what people say.
Okay. So I have a lot. So early on, I wanted to be an elementary school teacher. You know, I love being around kids. I love like making up songs and stuff. I just always have enjoyed that. But when I went to college, I intended to be a PE and math teacher and ended up in psychology. So
and how did that happen, though?
I took psychology as an elective. And I tried signing up for different classes, but I kept ending up with the same professor. I mean,
It was meant to be.
It was meant to be. So, yeah. So I ended up deciding that I was going to major in counseling. And so ended up doing that and working at the Counseling and Testing Center at Eastern Illinois University while I was in school. Since then, my best friend and I, we talked about being beauticians, and I figure it involves some of the same skills. You know, you talk with people and you help them feel better. When I was younger, I also wanted to be a nuclear physicist, and I wrote to NASA to let them know I was interested in coming to work for them. My mom told me they sent a letter back to me saying maybe I should write back after I finished high school. But lately, I've been thinking about being a park ranger. at the Katmai National Park so I could work with the bears. I know it sounds like a lot of different things, but really, if you drill down, all these things have the same skills.
Yeah, you know, they're all connected. I was going to say that. You know, you're teaching people, you're presenting, you're speaking, you're writing, you're doing all of those things that a teacher would do. It's just that your population may not be children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how the bears fit in with military veterans and personnel,
military
dogs could have PTSD, but I'm not sure if you can do EMDR on dogs. So I don't know anything about treating dogs with PTSD.
Well, that's a whole nother podcast, right? But it always involves being aware of systems, you know, the systems of which the animals are a part, people are a part. Wanting to improve situations and having compassion.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
If you're going to work with the military and or veterans, learn about the population. You know, you can do that by reading books like Mark Russell and Charles Figley's book on EMDR in the military, get consultation from someone with experience with that population, attend presentations, and join the EMDR military SIG. You know, currently Ted Lujnik and Lisa Robinson are the co-moderators. But there are so many clinicians out there who are passionate about treating our military and our veterans, who are willing to share in ideas about EMDR psychotherapy and the military. Talk with your colleagues. You know, don't sit with it yourself. If you have a question, contact somebody. You know, we're there for you.
That's great. We're going to close it out. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
This has been the Let's Talk EMDR podcast with our guest, Dr. Jamie Subukovic. Visit www.emdria.org for more information about EMDR therapy or to use our Find an EMDR Therapist directory with more than 13,000 therapists available. Our award-winning blog, Focal Point, offers information on EMDR and is an open resource. Thank you for listening.